Gen X Grown Up is a YouTube channel, website, and audio podcast you're listening to right now. All made for and by people who love exploring media, games, tech, and toys of yesterday and today through the eyes of Gen Xers who refuse to grow up. Your dinner cannot just be French fries.
Basically, life sucks as a grown-up. Welcome back, Gen X Grown Up podcast listeners, to this backtrack edition of the Gen X Grown Up podcast. I am John. Joining us, as always, is Mo. Mo? Did we lose Mo? We'll get that fixed. And of course, George is here. George? Hey, Mo? What? What happened? Oh, look at the calendar. It is April 1st, isn't it? Damn it. Well, that makes a lot more sense. Happy April Fool's Day, everyone. Gen X Grown Up this year is participating in the 2021 podcast switcheroo. It's an opportunity for our podcast to get out in front of some other listeners by being featured in their feed. And in exchange, we're featuring a fellow podcaster right here in our feed. Now, before you get upset and call shenanigans, the regularly scheduled Thursday episode of the Gen X Grown Up podcast will release a little bit later today. But right now, we invite you to give a listen to My Handle is Jonathan Blade. This is a long-running podcast about the pop cultural interests, pursuits, philosophical leanings, and the people surrounding the internet citizen, Jonathan Blade. Give it a listen. We hope you enjoy. And if you do, we hope you will head over and subscribe to My Handle is Jonathan Blade. With that somewhat goofy but very factual introduction out of the way, here's the show. And we will talk to you a little later today. No life, no fun. Don't
you know that you're a grown up? My handle is Jonathan Blade.
I've got a little sinus thing going on from just being ill on the weekend. Yeah. And also from like seasonal allergies and stuff, and it is killing me.
I got the same thing happening with the seasonal, and every single time I sneeze or cough, I'm like, oh, fuck, it's the COVID.
Welcome to my podcast. Today I'll be having the first of a series of open discussions on a topic of my guest's choice. It's actually quite fortuitous that today's guest was the first of the interested parties to submit a topic. I've known this person for decades. He is the person who opened the door on what was, after fatherhood, the most significant period of my life. He's a man of many hats, but today he enters the discussion with his media nerd hat firmly in place as we talk about the ascendancy of comic book movies from cult classics to cultural domination. Welcome, my dear old friend, Ray Bullock. Welcome to the show,
Ray. How you doing? I'm doing well.
Tondi with a T because you got two'd.
See, and that's the first time my name has ever been mentioned on the show. I'm going to keep in. No, you're good. I'm going to keep that in because I was planning on introducing myself anyway.
Okay.
People who keep up with me directly know that my name is not actually Jonathan Blade. So, yes.
Yeah, I was thinking about that before because as soon as you contacted me about this and we had to reschedule, I'm cleaning out a bunch of stuff like everybody is right now during the quarantine, and I came across the old Grins tape.
Grins? Yeah. You know what? I actually found a collection of Grins sets that I transcribed and I was going to put up on YouTube for Matt, but it's a little bit embarrassing. Like, it's very cool that we got to be on Grins and it really gave us national exposure, but yeah, those were the days.
I just remember the guy who was, like, I think 95 years old, pretty much a PA on the show, was trying to get our names and everything for the host, and you told him the name, and he said, oh, is your tagline, like, with a T, because he's got two, and all of us just looked at this guy, like, we will beat you to death for the good of the land if you speak again.
Yeah, why are we here is what comes to mind.
Right.
Oh. But no hating, because, you know, that was actually a really interesting experience. So I have nothing but love for our Grins days.
Most definitely.
All right, so why did you choose this topic, right?
Well, I chose this topic because I've actually been talking about it a lot with a lot of what I would call my nerd friends. And it's so weird to me that these type of things, your comic book movies and your sci-fi literature, your fantasy literature, if you did that, that guaranteed you to be a social outcast when you were in your late teens all the way through your early 20s. But now it's like the inmates have taken over the asylum And unless you're into those things, you're the social outcast now.
Yeah, no, it definitely did have an incredible cultural ascendancy. And I've been thinking about it, and I understand how the nerd culture itself became ascendant, but I don't understand how that culture came to dominate the entire media landscape. So I understand how boys became men who became powerful in a society with changing values. And for those men, that culture became something that became mainstream. But it's not just mainstream for those boys to men. It's mainstream for everybody. And I find that very interesting.
Well, I find it interesting, but I also found it to be a fantastic battle plan that, and I'll just call it nerd culture had. Well, the first real big major blockbuster nerd, superhero, however you want to call it, movie was the first Superman, Christopher Reeve, of course. That was like the real first big blockbuster. Up until that point, like the small serials they had in the 40s and the little television shows they had on Saturday mornings, but the first blockbuster was the Christopher Reeve Superman.
Yes, indeed. 300 million internationally.
Yeah. And for that time period, I mean, hell, if you want to do the conversion math, I put that on par with probably what Avengers did.
Oh, it was huge.
Yeah, yeah. But you weren't being true to the character. I don't recall in any Superman book that I had or have at present, and I have some that are dated back to the 60s, wherever he could multiply himself or reach into his chest and pull out a giant cellophane S to wrap his victims in. You know, I don't ever remember that ever happening. So they weren't being really true to the source material, which is every, you know, nerd's, you know, critique.
Oh, so you don't think that Superman the movie is true to the heart of the material?
Oh, no, it is.
Because I feel like it is. I feel like it might be one of the most honest, true adaptations to the core material ever made, given that it was the first of its kind. Like, you would think it would stray way farther from the source material as they're trying to appeal to a broad audience than it did. I think, man, the heart of Superman, the truth, justice, the American way, and the way that Christopher Reeves portrayed that character on screen is, man, it's chef's kiss.
On my own personal level, it is still one of my favorite comic book adaptations of all time, including every Marvel movie that's come out. Christopher Reeves made everybody believe that men could fly. That'll never be in doubt.
Yeah, in the time that it was released is a huge antic thing.
Oh, yeah. But they changed a couple of the dynamics of it. Like I said, they gave him some different powers. You know, they did a couple of other small little things. I don't ever remember Richard Pryor appearing in any of the books and Solid Gold Dancers putting on a nuclear suit. You know, stuff like they changed some things later on.
Yeah, we don't need to include Superman for the quest for peace. That's an Elseworld story.
Hey, without Superman Quest for Peace from Canon Pictures, we would not have gotten Masters of the Universe, that fine, fine gem of crap. but what my point being is that they changed it just enough so that it would piss off the diehard fans. Well, Superman never did this, never did this. So other people could sit there and say, well, the nerds don't like it, so it's okay if I like it.
See, I feel like there was a universality there just because, one, it was a super expensive blockbuster in a time where, like, I think that Star Wars, Superman, and Jaws came out in a fairly close period of time.
Yeah.
And those three blockbusters represented something special because there wasn't much out like that. Like, the studios didn't spend money on movies like that up to that point.
True.
So people had never seen anything like that. So whether it was good or not, it would have been appealing to a broader audience. It just also happens to be a really good movie.
But you made my point there. Whether it was good or not, it was still going to appeal to a lot of people. And I think after that, they, you know, like they did the whole quest for peace. They did the whole Richard Pryor, oh, well, it doesn't matter if it's good. They'll still eat it up with a spoon.
which is a philosophy that I believe DC Films has kept to this day.
their money men kind of run the board there.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that was true up until recently when they start being more experimental. I will say that although it doesn't seem that any one person is at the helm of what Warner is doing with those movies, the fact that they stopped trying to have a Marvel-style showrunner, somebody who is the overarching manager of the project. And I think they actually do have somebody like that, but they're not doing it in the same way. So these properties can hypothetically be connected, but they're not literally connected right now. I think is probably the best way to go, because nobody is going to be able, and I think this might be true across the board. I think 10 years of studios saying, man, we need to get ourselves a cinematic universe, there's a possibility that might be have gone by the wayside, because nobody can do what Marvel did. I'm not sure what the combination of magic was, but yeah, they kind of wasted money trying to get a plan together to do what Marvel did, and 10 years later, nobody has done what the Disney did with the MCU.
No, and it won't be done again. I don't think you can't capture lightning twice. I mean, DC tried, and I'll go on record, I don't care about the Snyder Cut. It can be dead and buried for all I care. I don't want to see it. It shouldn't exist. They fired you for a reason. Move on with your life. But I think, but back to the rise of it, then the next big one that you had was Batman. Michael Keaton, Tim Burton.
Which is like 11 years later.
Yeah, because they fell back into the whole, oh, it's still nerd stuff. Well, then Michael Keaton, Batman already had a massive popularity with non-nerds. The skater culture adopted him as kind of a mascot. You know, I remember tons of kids when I was that age wearing Batman t-shirts who had never read a Batman comic book in their life, but it was like the popular logo of the time.
See, I feel like the Batman movie capitalizes on something that is fairly special. There are two factors that kept people around for comic books and brought them on in a time of people feeling disenfranchised. And that factor, the Margaret Thatcher era British comic book writers, because they felt disenfranchised. And then in America, Frank Miller. So Miller and those Margaret Thatcher era British comic book writers wrote some really cynical stuff that kept fans on past their childhood, basically, or might have even brought them in their early adolescence. And people remember that. They remember that transition as transitioning to something more mature. They might even associate that with maturity, even though it's not. It's kind of a sophomoric between stage from childhood into adolescence and then on to whatever follows. And, you know, a lot of people stop there because they're like, ah, this is adulthood. But I think that brought fans on in a way that those fans stayed fans even as they got older. They're like, no, this is mature stuff. Not Frank Miller or British writer, but I remember showing my mother an issue of the Punisher, and I don't remember who wrote it, but I think it was either Walt Portasio or Jim Lee that did the art, and it was super gritty. And I was like, yeah, comic books they're not just for kids. I mean, look at this. This is like gritty. And she ripped it in half in front of me. And she said, don't ever bring anything like this in my house ever again.
but that's also a great point, especially of the rise of it. I mean, you have other things besides comic books. Like you said, they started to hold on to their readers throughout their growth. I mean, back in the old days of it, comic books were just a kid's fodder. It was just their toys at the time, and they just kept writing and writing for those kids over and over and over again. None of them started to really change with their readers, I want to say, until the late 70s, early 80s. But that started to give leeway to other genres of quote-unquote nerddom. Let's take the Harry Potter franchise, for example. It's not dying. It's not going anywhere. And it's been, it's been 20 years at this point. And I think that's because as she started to grow as a writer, her readers started to grow as well. So she kind of matured right along with them.
She did. And then she kind of took her legs out from underneath her with the with the Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah. Don't disrespect people, especially when you're writing a bunch of books about respecting people.
Don't
do that. Don't do that, lady. You messed up. I don't know if I can say the F word on your show, but you messed up.
It's really open. I have lots of awkward random Fs throughout the podcast. You're good to go.
But then you got people like your George R. R. Martin, who, and I don't care what anybody says, I love the dude, but I've got different reasons for that, who pretty much saw all these people that, you know, grew up with, like, different, like, Lady Bird and, you know, Dragon Slayer and all that, and said, hey, they were lonely a good portion of their life. What do they want? They want sex and a lot of death. So let's give them that. And he was around for a while. People forget that he was writing sci-fi and fantasy stuff from 1980 on. He was one of the writers for the old Beauty and the Beast series with Ron Perlman.
Yeah, I don't know how people didn't understand, even if you think that this stuff is for a younger audience, how people didn't understand that sex is, like, straight up sex is the real thing missing from a lot of this. I guess it's because they want to bring it to a, especially now, when the media, when the movie industry found out that the magic key to making $1 billion on a movie was making it for the entire family audience. But sex was the magic key to bringing in a more consistent audience for, I feel like, anything.
Oh, agreed.
Especially now, because there's no sex in a lot of the sanitized media that we consume, because there doesn't have to be, because there's free porn everywhere. So you don't see as many studio films that have hardcore, like, sexuality in them, but I would like to see something as sexy as Patrick Willems recently did an episode where he was talking about the Catherine Zeta-Jones and Antonio Banderas movie, The Mask of Zorro.
Yes.
And how it was an incredibly fun action movie, but it was so damn sexy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's right, that sexiness, that Banderas sexiness and stuff like Desperado and the Zorro movie, that is a huge draw.
Yeah.
I'm not sure
Well, and
how
that also explains why the sequel to Zorro, The Legend of Zorro, tanked the box office, because they had a kid, and we all know once you have a kid, a lot of sex just disappears.
Your truth is painful, but yes, it is true.
No, that was the rise of it, I think. I think a lot of your sci-fi writers, your comic book writers, all of that realized that, hey, because we have a little bit of a older fan base now, we can start throwing in things like sexuality and sex and all of that. And I think that was another boost into pretty much them taking over. Because you had a whole group of children that their escape was the sci-fi and comic book genre. That it was an escape for me anyway, you know. The lonely weird kid who liked to isolate himself, we had to have something, and that's what we had. And then when we got older, it was like, oh, we still have this, and there's boobies too? Awesome.
Yeah, that umbrella is a pretty big Wii, too. That is a that is a pretty big umbrella. There are a lot of us.
Yeah.
So, I spent money on comic books like they were crack cocaine back in the day. When I got a job, like, a ridiculous percentage of my income went to going to Frank's store sometimes twice a week to pick up my haul plus a little bit extra.
Oh, dude, I remember. I ran into you a couple of times at Frank's store, and also a couple of times at KB Toys when we worked at that restaurant together.
The evil flingers slash, what was it called in waiting?
Yeah.
Shenanigans.
Shenanigans.
Yeah.
Oh, God. There are pieces of my soul that are still attached to that wall.
Yeah, on the tchotchkes, yeah.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
There's a picture of a man with a bar handle mustache, and your soul is somewhere in that bar handle mustache.
Right. Well, if I could go on, also on record again, if anyone ever sees me working at one of those big box restaurant stores again, just please, just take me out back and put me down like I was Seabiscuit with a broken leg, because I can't. Oh, God, wasted youth. Anyway.
No, it's not wasted if you can take some experiences away from it.
Oh, very true.
Actually,
and I have some great experience.
I purchased Waiting recently because I hadn't seen it in a while.
Yeah.
And I watched it, and it's a dumbass movie, and it's not really about anything, but it's also quite honest. Like, they're exaggerated a little bit, but that is pretty much... Robert said, I was talking to Robert about it, and he's like, yes, it is pretty much up and down. Not the today restaurant experience. Probably people are more intelligent about their lives. They don't think that there's no future or care about that like they did in the 90s. We were like, life's meaningless because we don't have any challenges, so we're just going to party till we die. But yeah.
These kids today will never know what it's like to do a bump of cocaine off of something in dry storage. I tell you, they're spoiled. They're spoiled, I say.
Or off the back of the toilet. Or and neither do we.
No, of course not. No, but that never happened ever.
But Waiting is pretty close to that experience.
Yeah,
it's pretty close to the genuine experience.
Well, I was actually talking, and this goes back to the topic at hand. That whole realm was an escape for me, especially during that time period. Like, I mean, I spent money on comic books and tchotchkes that were like nerd related, like nobody's business back in those days, because it was like, you know, this is life and blah, blah, blah. And I don't know if I'll ever get out of here. And I mentioned that to a younger person that I know that's working in the restaurant field now. It's like, yeah, that's why everybody likes it now. That's why everybody's into nerd culture now, because we know there's no hope anymore. It's not that we're lost without hope. It's like, we know there's no hope. We know it's not going to happen. The majority of us are going to be working two jobs for the rest of our lives. We know this. And I'm like, damn, that's bleak. And she looked right at me and said, yeah, I know. Now I got to go do some coke and dry storage. So
is it just modern day escapism? Is it our escape? Or is it as Kevin Smith hypothesizes, the modern day religion?
I think all escapism is a religion at some point, you know? Hence the term, you do it religiously. I think religion was an escape for a lot of folks in the early onsets of religion. Especially in this country and the society that we have. Oh, hey, this is completely untamed land. We have to commit a couple of genocides in order to have a house, and you got to build it, and your family's probably going to die when they're 7 years old because of a hangnail or something of that nature. But you can escape every Sunday and hear these words that this person is spewing out that seem magical and seem unattainable. And you can do that for a while to escape what you had to go through for this week. So, I mean, I think even religion is a form of escapism.
Well,
but that's just me. I'm not meaning to piss people off, and I know you'll probably get some emails over that, but...
Oh, believe me, I won't. The three people that listen to the podcast are very elevated in their thinking, and so we're going to be all good. Thanks, Shahir. No, I don't agree with the modern-day religion hypothesis. I do think it's a modern-day institution. It might even be a social institution, these things existing, but religion creates a framework for society, makes people more manageable, it helps society exist. Now those rules can be replaced by other things. I think the modern day religion is capitalism. I think that especially for Americans, our modern day religion is capitalism, which is poison.
Greed.
It's so dangerous, but it's what we have, so that's what we're working with right now.
I there's a lot of truth in that statement. I'll very much agree. That's why we need to reopen this country, and 100,000 people dying is going to be totally fine.
That's how you learn your lessons through capitalism, I guess.
Exactly. But not to get too far into that whole fuck 45. Anyway.
So we got up to the 89 Batman. And...
Yeah, we got to. Oh yeah. Well, then you had like that slew that just came out of
where everybody wanted to be the 89 Batman.
Yeah, that followed the 89 Batman. Just a slew of comic book movies that tried to come out. And I think the part that they missed, they went so far away from what those books were supposed to be.
Well,
I mean,
they were working with
I actually like
I like the Billy Zane Phantom. I thought that was pretty true to the story and all that.
So you know, I have never seen the Billy Zane Phantom.
If you're a Phantom fan, for people that don't know the Phantom except from the Defenders of the Universe cartoon.
Defenders of the Earth.
Defenders. Of the Earth. Defenders of the Earth. Excuse me. I am so sorry. I lost nerd points there.
No, you're just you're not also, quite as old as I am, so I'll give you that.
Yeah, which is also on Amazon Prime, and they're not sending me a check at all to keep plugging them. I thought that one was pretty true to it, but like the Judge Dredd that Sylvester Stallone did.
In love.
Yeah, the only thing that had in common with the actual Judge Dredd books was the title Judge Dredd. And that's just it. I think they tried to keep it alive by trying to change it to appeal to a broader audience when they didn't have to. They could just put forth what was already there and they were going to appeal to a broader audience. Which is what ended up happening with, like, your Iron Man movies and Spider-Man 2s and things of this nature. They thought they had to change it in order to get people involved. But due to the fact that it had already been mainstream for so long, when they started to present the actual stories, it was much more palatable for everybody. And that's why they went along.
I think that Spider-Man 2 is very faithful to the older, the Ditko canon that Sam Raimi wanted to put on screen, but Iron Man, I feel like Iron Man's its own beast. Like, Tony Stark, the things that defined Tony Stark before Robert Downey Jr. was that he was unstable and he was an arrogant asshole, but he wasn't funny, and he wasn't really as self-aware as Robert Downey Jr.'s character is. Like, Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark knows who he is. He knows those qualities that he has that people are like, I both love this guy and kind of hate him at the same time.
I think the
comic book Tony Stark is not that aware of himself. He's just an arrogant asshole. He's a rich guy and he thinks he's the smartest man in the room. When in the comic books, he's not even the smartest man in the room. Reed Richards is the smartest man in the room. So, yeah.
Well, see, that's just it. I think I hate to disagree with you there. I think in the books, Tony Stark knows his shortcomings, he knows all of that, much like you said, but also like Robert Downey Jr., he doesn't care. He just doesn't care because he doesn't have to care because he's a billionaire. And he does think he's the smartest person. Even in the Avengers films, when he and Bruce Banner are having back and forth, you have that sense of, I feel like I'm better, Tony Stark, I feel like I'm better than you.
No, definitely, but that's because he is. He in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Tony Stark is the smartest man in the room. And because of that, in the modern comic books, he's also the smartest man in the room, but it wasn't always that way. It was Reed Richards.
You couldn't introduce Reed Richards because they hadn't bought out Fox yet.
No, that is true. Yeah. And at this point, I'm very curious to see that. I'm a huge Fantastic Four fan, and I don't really see a way that they will not... There's a huge chance of effing it up.
They're going to eff it up. I bow down to the mouse. I really do. Because what they've done in the last 10 years has been amazing.
Amazing.
I will line up to see every single one of those films. But
Hold on. Let's save that for a beat until we get there. Because there is plenty of praise to be given to what Disney has accomplished, which is one of the most amazing cultural things that we've probably seen in our lifetime. But before we get there, there was the 90s. We got through the 90s. Superhero movies became big box office, hypothetically, because of Batman. Did anybody actually achieve the kind of box office that Batman did? No,
nope.
Nobody did. But I don't think they ever went as hard, like, budget-wise, because it's all about... It's about solid writing and getting the right actors and having your movie look good, but it's mostly about money.
Yeah. I'm the only person in the world who did not like Tim Burton's Batman, I think.
Oh, you didn't like Tim Burton's Batman?
I did not like Tim Burton's Batman.
You didn't like Returns either?
No, I did not.
Oh, well, let me ask you this. Do you like Tim Burton generally as a director?
I love Tim Burton. I enjoy the hell out of Tim Burton. In my own personal opinion, Helen Bonham Carter, Johnny Depp, and Tim Burton can make movies until the cows come home, and I will watch all of them. I think I'm the only person in the world who actually clapped a little bit at the end of Alice in Wonderland, because I enjoyed the film.
When Johnny Depp did that little dance, you clapped?
I did!
It hurts. It hurts. Stop, Ray. Your words are kryptonite. Oh.
But no, they couldn't recapture... I don't think they could recapture what Batman did, because they couldn't find a property that was already established in people that didn't know the property. Like I was saying, Batman was already established through a lot of skater culture and a lot of what was hip at the time,
even with people who had never read a Batman comic book, because it was like the symbol that was adopted for a lot of folks. Mm-hmm. And there was no other comic book character at that time who had had that. You know, you didn't see a lot of people, you know, with a, well, let's just go with Judge Dredd. Judge Dredd written on their book covers in school, or a Judge Dredd t-shirt who wasn't already a comic book fan.
No, that's so true, but those people didn't get to experience the Simon Bisley Judge Dredd directly. I don't know if the more recent Dredd movie would have done well in the 90s, but man, that was a good movie. The Stallone movie was very much a 90s movie, but it wasn't Judge Dredd. It was a Stallone movie.
Oh, I agree. 150% I agree. Well, that's what I'm saying. They changed it too much, feeling like they could appeal to the people who weren't already a little bit of a fan. You didn't need to appeal to people that weren't already a little bit of a fan with Batman, because it was adopted as a logo for a lot of the youth.
Yeah, and it was a pre-existing property. It was something that people already knew about. It was a generational investment. So yeah. If there hadn't been a Batman TV series in the 70s, off of which they could have built capital, and if there hadn't been a Batman cartoon and seeing Batman on the Super Friends... Yeah. Then if you didn't have that cachet already built in, then you wouldn't have been able to do a Batman that was even as close as it was, probably. So there's also that generational investment is very important.
Exactly. If you come out with the films that came out in the 90s that were comic book related, a lot of those properties didn't have that pre-existing acknowledgement. I mean, you had your Roger Corman, like Captain America and all that, but it was also a Roger Corman movie, so there was no way in hell that was going to do anything.
Well, that one never got released, did it?
It did direct-to-video.
Oh, that's right. See, it was a Fantastic Four that never got released.
Yeah, and with good reason, because, oh my God, that was so awful. I have a copy of that still, and I'm just like, oh, Jesus.
You know, now that we're in the 90s, there actually is a 90s... cheap superhero film that I'm a fan of, and it's
Which
not
one?
That it's a good movie, but I liked Dolph Lundgren's Punisher movie.
I love Dolph Lundgren's Punisher movie.
Yeah, like the only problem with that movie for me is Dolph Lundgren.
Up until the Netflix series, that was one of the more accurate portrayals of the character.
Yeah.
I love Thomas Jane, don't get me wrong. Hung is a great series, but don't ever do another Punisher film.
Yeah, I was not a big fan of Thomas Jane's Punisher movie.
Yeah, or Ray Stevens, I think his name is.
So I liked Warzone. I also didn't think it was a great movie, but I liked it more than I liked Thomas Jane's movie.
I agree. It wasn't a great movie, but I liked it a lot more than Thomas Jane's. And whenever you say, hey, John Travolta is going to be your big bad, I'm like, yeah, no, I don't. No, I'm good.
And then,
I'm good.
And then we get to a place, as we're going through the 90s, we actually get to a place where changing the property actually makes a difference for the draw. It actually brings in people, and we get to that place where it starts changing the character in the comic book, which is something that we'd seen before. Actually, I remember after the Tim Burton Batman movies and the comic book, Batman goes away for a time, Dick Grayson becomes Batman, and when Batman comes back, he has the all-black costume to mirror what's going on in the movies. But at the end of the 90s, we get the iconic... Blade the Vampire Hunter. Blade was not at all that character before Wesley Snipes, but after Wesley Snipes, much like Robert Downey Jr., after Wesley Snipes, Blade could only be Wesley Snipes.
I'm not according to Disney, because someone else could be. But anyway, no, I can't.
Mahershala Ali. Mahershala Ali is the perfect choice for that if they're going for somebody to be like a Wesley Snipes-style Blade. So I've got nothing but love for that decision.
But even in the 90s, I think the only other real property that became like a huge standout besides Batman, of course, then you start getting into the Batman animated series and things of that nature, which college students were literally changing their class schedule around so they could watch episodes. I think we have to talk about the impact that X-Men animated series had on that push.
Yeah, that and the 90s Spider-Man cartoon brought in a whole new generation of fans. I liked the idea of both those shows, and I thought in their execution, like, because they had some strong, mature ideas in the shows, but in execution, they didn't execute on those mature ideas because they wanted to do something that wasn't completely serialized. They wanted to do just episode. So when they'd start doing things that were more serialized, it was later on, and I didn't love either one of those shows. Well, at the time, I wanted them to both be more like BTS, like Batman the Animated Series. It was more maturely written. Even after it stopped being a primetime show and became an afternoon show, and the writing changed a little bit, it was still a way better written show than either the X-Men show or the Spider-Man show.
I agree. Well, not every 90s cartoon could have been Gargoyles. I'm just saying.
Yeah, Gargoyles was fantastic.
It was fantastic. I can't wait to make the movie already, for crying out loud. You know. But back to the whole timeline of it, I think that started to open up a little bit more of non-fans. It was a slow, gradual process. I also am a firm believer that without the X-Men cartoon, without the Spider-Man cartoon, we wouldn't have gotten the movies.
Oh, I mean, you are probably 100% correct there. Yeah. There's always going to have to be a feeling out of the waters, and that's also probably why those were the first two. Maybe not so much for Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. I think a Spider-Man movie was kind of inevitable, but the X-Men movie definitely built off the cachet built by Chris Claremont's run that people were familiar with, and then off of that cartoon. Well, and I guess just the iconic Jim Lee imagery, even if people of the 90s didn't know anything about the... Who's a writer for Jim Lee's artist run? Who wrote the X-Men at that point in time? Had Chris Claremont come back to the book, or did Jim Byrne write?
I think he went through a couple of writers at that time.
So when
Marvel was doing the big shakeup because they lost so many people due to Image.
Yeah, but that was after that. So when Marvel launched the No Superlative X-Men series, Jim Lee was the main artist for that, and I think it might have been Chris Claremont again, actually. But
I think you're right, but I'm not 100% on that.
But Chris Claremont's images, his renditions of the X-Men were on T-shirts and lunchboxes and everywhere. So that was part of that too.
I think the comics, even though they were being sold in millions and millions of copies, that's only because the diehards are buying up every crossover.
The collector's market?
Yeah, type of thing. It wasn't because of the people that hadn't been exposed to it were all of a sudden becoming comic book fans. I mean, you had a lot of kids were, but your teenagers and your adults weren't there with it. Now, granted, a lot of the kids were watching the X-Men cartoon, and some of their parents had to watch it with them to keep the kids quiet. And I've actually talked to a couple people that said, yeah, I got into X-Men because my kid was watching the X-Men cartoon, and I got into it like that.
Really?
Yeah. A friend of mine, Ron, actually, who was much older, who is now an avid comic book reader and fan, got into that whole genre because he had a son who watched X-Men in the afternoon.
Yeah, I could definitely see that being a thing. There's anime stuff that I've only looked at because Grayson was into it, so I do feel that.
Well, see, that's just... I think that one of the reasons why it has ingratiated the culture so much is because people can actually see it. They don't have to pick up the book, or they don't have to, you know, find the 15 issues that reference this, that, or the other thing.
The books are now just a loss leader to promote the other media that makes the money.
Exactly.
Although we'll see how that paradigm shifts in the age of COVID, COVID-19.
True, but I'm still going to stick with the famous Stan Lee quote. Comic books are just like boobs. Yeah, you can see them on the internet, but there's something about holding one in your hand.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, Stan Lee. Papa Stan taught us a lot, but anyway.
Papa Stan did teach us a lot. He's pretty significant in my history as a comic book nerd. But so we get to the 2000s. We get to the X-Men movie. I didn't love the X-Men movie, and in the big picture, I don't think it is as important as some people imagine. Some people say that Blade is the beginning of the boom. I don't think that it is. Some people say that the X-Men movie is the beginning of the boom. I don't think that that is either. I actually don't think the first X-Men movie is very good, but...
I agree with you there, and there's something I'll go back and watch, and I'll be like, oh, okay, yeah, that's nice. I think the beginning of the big boom was the first Spider-Man film.
Exactly. The first Spider-Man movie is the beginning of the modern boom.
Everything up to that helped it boom, because people were used to seeing superheroes on their screens and that nature. And plus, again, back a big generational buildup. Everybody knew who Spider-Man was because he had been around forever. But you mentioned something earlier, if I could backtrack to it. Stanley had a reality show called Who Wants to Be a Superhero?
Uh-huh.
For a while. If you haven't seen it, it's cheeky, it's fun. But in that, one of the characters, one of the people on the show, thanks Stan Lee at one point, because he actually said, when I was coming up, I did not have a dad. I had a single mom. Spider-Man taught me how to be respectful. He taught me right from wrong. Reed Richards taught me it was important to study in school. And I think, again, it's back to that escapism. A lot of people coming up couldn't escape into comic books because, well, even though comic books were everywhere, they were in comic book stores and not a lot of people had access to them, but they had access to the cartoons. They had access to the films eventually. They were much more accessible than the actual comic books. And I think with the advent of so much media, because this is also the time in the early 2000s when you're seeing the rise of the internet, we had the access to it. I mean, Stan Lee himself came up with that whole slew of superheroes that were internet superheroes. I forget the name of them. They lasted all of about 2 weeks, but it was still a thing. But that puts us in the 2000 market, and you have that big boom of Spider-Man. And I feel it's because, again, that whole escapism, and people were looking for more of an escape, because anybody who lived through the 90s, it was not a happy decade. A lot of us were wearing flannel and not bathing a lot, and people, you know, discovered patchouli again. It was not a good time.
There were a lot of stinky people in the late 90s.
Yes, yes. So, but back to 2000, the 2000s and the big boom. Sorry.
No, one thing that the 2000s brings us with that first Spider-Man movie is something that I was reading an article from the New York Times and one from the New York Fine Arts something about this very subject. And two things, or one thing that both articles covered, was the idea that these things became vehicles for increasingly more impressive special effects.
Yeah.
And I think that holds true from that first Spider-Man movie. CGI in that movie, that final swing, is still incredibly impressive. I mean, it looks like CGI, but it's still incredibly impressive. The effects in general in that movie, it's still a good-looking movie. Even the things that you're like, that might not hold up. Or like the train scenario in Spider-Man 2, still amazing.
Yeah.
And with the ascendancy of CGI and them being able to just supplement practical effects. So you still have a scene that can be shot practically, so you have the... just the impressive nature of having something that you can put your hands on, you actually see that building crumble, whatever, and then you just give it a little extra zip with the CGI, and you come out with something that is impressive. It's not something that they had before to that level. It's kind of like a magic dividing line. Well, I guess Jurassic Park is the real magic dividing line between before CGI was super impressive and when it wasn't, but nobody achieved Jurassic Park levels of quality in their CGI, and probably until the 2000s. So Spider-Man is what I consider that dividing line for superhero movies. Like there were things
done. Spider-Man was, for special effects, what for that particular time period, what Star Wars was for special effects for that time period.
Yeah, Spider-Man and Lord of the Rings too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
But you know, Spider-Man is playing in this particular arena. So I think it's not just the superhero aspect of it, it's the spectacle aspect, mm-hmm. but the hero aspect and the larger-than-life aspect thing can cross a bunch of genres that are action-oriented. And we happened to get, in that period, we got the Spider-Man movie, but we also got Lord of the Rings movie. It was a pretty cool time to be a moviegoer.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. But that's just it. It's, you have people of all, because a lot of these characters and a lot of these franchises have been around 50 plus years. I mean, what isn't it like Superman's 87th year or something of that nature?
It's like his 79th, 82nd, something crazy. Yeah, so
yeah, he's something he's, insane.
What was it, 1938?
Yeah. So like, I mean, 82nd. You have all those people that are still alive that have seen all of these franchises. I mean, your Iron Mans, your Thors, your Lord of the Rings, all of that, and now they're finally, and they know them from their youth, even if they weren't fans of them or read them or anything of that nature, they heard the name when they were younger from somebody. And now they can go back with a little bit of nostalgia and also a little bit of curiosity and actually see it in front of them in all of its epic grand scale.
And that, I think, special.
Is also part of it.
No, it is. It's definitely something special. And I would have killed to have the experience that my son is. And it's nothing to my son because his whole life is filled with spectacle. Every day there's something spectacular that he can just see at will. So it's not the same. He's probably kind of a little bit callous to it all. But I would kill to have the experience of seeing those things through a 10-year-old's eyes.
Oh, man. Oh, man. I can't even imagine.
Like I mean,
I would love to.
And we'll get there, but the feelings that I had seeing the Avengers on screen, like as an adult, are almost indescribable. So to be able to have seen those through a 10-year-old's eyes, I can't even imagine.
Well, see, and I think that's also part of why it's become such this big cultural movement, because people are saying we finally get to see this move and talk like we thought it would. It's no longer just on the page. The dragon is real. You know, it's going to fly for us, or Thor is actually going to hit somebody with a hammer. We actually get to see it now, and I think that's why it's become such a big thing, because you can read about it and you can talk about it with your friends, or you make pretend when you're in your younger years, but when you can actually see it happening, that's an experience you don't want to pass up and you can't pass up. I made the joke when I think after the... Were you with us when we went to see Spider-Man 2, the midnight showing?
I don't think so.
That was a famous... I remember... That's another story for another time. But I remember sitting down and seeing the first Spider-Man, and I made a joke about it on stage for probably a lot longer than I should have. For everybody that was sitting there in that theater that had grown up with Spider-Man and we started to watch it, if any one of us would have started masturbating, we all would have been cool with it because we would have understood. We would have understood.
You know, actually, I don't really care for Tobey Maguire that much.
He was a whiny little bit.
Yeah, but I still respect those as the cinematic benchmarks that they are.
Oh yeah.
And
oh,
also yeah. Heading into preceding that era a little bit, something else I want to talk about as we go through this is,
please,
you know, we're talking about the significance and how these became cultural juggernauts, but there is another cultural juggernaut that's kind of putting along at the same time that these movies are gaining ascendancy, that's Star Wars.
Oh yeah,
Star Wars is right on the side the entire time, and most of the time, as far as pop cultural cachet, Star Wars has a greater pop cultural cachet than all of the comic book franchises combined. Even when there's not a current movie, and somehow George Lucas, he may or may not be a brilliant creative. A genius, but man, the dude marketed the hell out of a franchise, and it never left the pop cultural mind space. There were always comic books, there were always toys. He did the re-releases and then the prequels, and all the while keeping Star Wars in the cultural space for a new generation. It was brilliant. So my question to you is, what separates the pop cultural cachet and the ascendancy of these comic book movies in the space from what Star Wars has done, has achieved, and is in the pop cultural headspace?
Nothing. I don't think anything separates them. I really don't. I think they're on par, like you said, if not even surpassing it.
Like, but again, we have generations now that have seen or heard. I mean, even people that haven't seen Star Wars, which, by the way, if you find somebody who says, I've never seen a Star Wars movie, one, they're probably lying to sound cool and hipsterish, and they're drinking an IPA out of their, you know, bio-friendly straw jockstrap or whatever the hell they're wearing to sound cool. But if they legitimately haven't seen it, please ask them, what was it like to be raised by wolves? Because that's the only thing there. But much like with the even with the comic book thing, people are getting upset with the new ones and saying, oh, well, that's not my version of it, and blah, 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 blah. And I think one of the things that we have to remind ourselves, especially with this big cultural boom, and for those of us who have been a part of it all of our lives, not all of it's meant solely for you. And I think there is a little bit of selfishness. And you can see that in the Star Wars fans, as well as the comic book fans.
The age of everybody having a voice has been the biggest poison to pop culture that I can ever imagine. Yeah. Who would have thunk it?
Yeah, they're not for you. Shut up. Go home, smoke a joint, take a poop, eat some Fruit Loops, do whatever it is you got to do. This one's not 100% for you. It's still enjoyable as hell, and I know it's enjoyable as hell because you paid to see it just like I did, and you're talking about it, and you're continuing to talk about it, so it's done its job. I sat in on a panel at last year's con, and they were talking about Robin. I forget the guy's name. He wrote, he was one of the writers on Long Halloween.
Loeb?
Cocaine's a hell of a drug. Don't, it messes with your memory. But anyway, he said, who is your favorite? He pointed out some guy in the audience who said some snidey remark about it not being written like it's supposed to, which, first of all, if you don't have any idea how it's supposed to be written because you're not a comic book writer, you're a guy buying the stuff, so you're a mark, as wrestling fans would say, sit down and shut up and eat what I'm feeding you. But the guy asked him, he said, who's your favorite Robin? And he said, well, I don't know. It's like, it doesn't matter because Robin is not for you. Robin has nothing to do with you. It's not for you. Your guy is Batman. You follow Batman. Robin is there for the 7 or 8-year-old who wants to be like Batman one day, but can't 100% identify with Batman. So we put this little guy in there so they have something to look at. Says, oh, that reminds me of me. And then eventually as they grow up, they're going to start to like Batman more, and a new person's going to come along and look at Robin. And then he went on to say, that's who the new Jedi are. They are for this new generation. They are for the people that are discovering it, because whether or not you want to admit it, you're going to die one day. And we need people that are still going to be interested in this.
So we can take their money.
Exactly. Exactly. Again, back to what you said earlier, man. Capitalism is the religion.
Damn straight it is. Damn straight. So we get to the era of studios trying desperately to make some money off of these franchises. In the previous decade, it was Batman they were trying to follow. In the decade before that, it was the Superman model, but nobody was really trying to follow Superman. It was too expensive. It was too risky.
Exactly.
The effects weren't there. To make a movie the level of Superman, you would have to take a huge risk that no studio felt that they could afford. It became easier by the 2000s because of CGI, basically, that they could do something of scope and of scale and believe that they would get a return on their investment. So everybody's like, oh, well, Spider-Man did block gangbusters. It's one of the most successful movies of all time. Let's do it. And so they tried, and they tried, and crappy movies were made. We had, the Fantastic Four movies, both of them.
Oh, God.
We had some X-Men movies, which, they're not bad. X2 is actually quite good, but, you know, it's still a movie of its time.
Yeah.
You have things like, Superman Returns, which is an interesting film and is not bad, but it's kind of boring. And I'm not sure what Bryan Singer was going for there.
The pacing is what killed that movie.
Yeah.
I also don't like
Lois Lane. I don't like that. Who was that actress that played Lois Lane in that movie?
Poor person, Vinnie Adams.
It doesn't matter. She was not great. I did like Spacey as Lex Luthor. I thought he did a great job, and I would have liked to have seen more.
And that's all he ever did anything good at, ever.
No, Kevin Spacey could be the shittiest human being on Earth. Maybe he's one of them, but that doesn't take away from the fact that the man...
I was just saying that to provoke you, dude. I was just saying that to provoke you. Okay. I've known you long enough to know what your response was going to be to that. He is the shittiest person ever, but he's still made some great stuff.
He was a great actor. He was a great actor. But the studios were just trying to kick out something. Even the Batman Begins, which came out in that period, didn't do huge business. It did all right. It did well enough to get a sequel. But it didn't do huge business. Huge business didn't come back until 2008. And 2008 is, I think people may believe that the current boom is punctuated by the Avengers. Maybe it is. But I'm going to say that it's before that. It's 2008 with Iron Man and The Dark Knight.
Mm-hmm.
That dual combo in that year, two movies that did extraordinarily well and were also extraordinarily good movies.
Yeah. But
both of them are fantastic movies. I still think that that first Iron Man movie, while different from everything else in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is one of the best movies, top third of the movies in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Well, it goes the old adage, you get what you pay for. And I think studios decided if we're going to do this, we have to get, like, the top-tier people to do it. And no offense to Billy Zane, back to the Phantom, but if you're getting Billy Zane to headline your movie, you're not going to do but so much with it. All right? You get people like your Heath Ledger and your Robert Downey Jr. and folks like that that have good, strong acting ability that can actually communicate it, like Christopher Reeve did. I think one of the many reasons why the first Superman movie started that whole boom was when Christopher Reeve said, "I'm here to fight for truth, justice, and the American way," he was believable. You believed that what he was saying was true for him. And I think the fact that finally they decided to put some time and some effort into these films is what got them the big exposure and the big business that they were doing. Because they stopped being, oh, this is the thing that you watch with the popcorn, and they started being good films. Solid, good films, despite what Martin Scorsese wants to say. We don't need to see the same movie every 2 years for 25 years, Martin. Let's move on.
Yeah, Scorsese's a whole other thing. And, you know, his opinion is as valid, if not more valid, than anyone else who would speak up in that space. But he's one man, and if to the modern generation, how you define cinema and how you define movies is something different, then, you know, you are still more than welcome to share your opinion that that is not cinema to you, and that could be right to you, but it may not be correct in the face of what entertains a modern audience. I'm an old person, and I love...
I'm an old person, too. You're not that much older than me, dude. We only separate each other by, what, 3-4 years?
Okay, so we're old people, and we love these movies.
Yeah.
Just the experience of, even if they are, if you just consider them cinematic thrill rides, it is something unique.
Yeah.
That previous generations, like, it may have started with Star Wars, it may have started with the Ten Commandments, but that kind of cinematic spectacle consistently is something that previous generations have not experienced.
I agree.
Even if you think of it as a cinematic thrill ride, that's something new, and it is beautiful. And so that actually might be the bulk of the draw there. Well, the bulk of the draw is that as time has gone on, the marketing for these things, the marketing budget for these things, the brands being everywhere, the ability of corporations to keep it in our headspace because of the internet, advertising is constant even if we don't know it. That's probably the other part of that, but the expense of paying to put images on screen that you would not see anywhere else may be the bulk of it. This idea that these hero characters are universal is true. The idea of a hero character is universal. The idea of an Uberman, somebody who's more powerful, an angelic being who defends humanity, is kind of universal as well. But it doesn't have to be the tights and spandex class. It just happens to be that in our generation. Like, it could be a wushu master in a 1990s or 2000s wushu epic. Could be the Lone Ranger, who's able to wield a handgun like it's a sharpshooter's rifle. Could be any of that stuff for its time. But this idea of an elevated human who comes in and saves us is not, it's not unique.
So, well, it's not neat. We'll go back to the very start of the conversation. Here's this figure who is able to do all of these miraculous and wonderful things, and they're here to save every single one of us. Don't you want to be like them? Come back and hear more about them next week. I mean, that's been a thing since we all came out of the caves in the darkness, and somebody stood up and started talking to us about the multi-gods and then, of course, the many one. To go back to what we said at the beginning, I think this is a religion for a lot of folk, and they follow it like a religion, and the religion is starting to spread.
Yeah, I mean, as an idea, it definitely is. Universal. The branding of these characters is universal. Like, even though Captain America is Captain America, America is a global brand.
Yeah.
Everybody knows, at this point, everybody knows who Captain America is, and everybody probably knows who Chris Evans is, so...
Yeah. Well, everybody knows who Jesus is. He's the only white Middle Eastern 2,000 years ago.
Exactly. So... we get into the final period of this exercise, which actually does start with the Avengers. $1.5 billion, a worldwide phenomenon. It is something that literally made nerds like us cream our pants. I do remember loving The Dark Knight tremendously and enjoying that experience and the experience of seeing Iron Man in the theater. It's not even close. The experience of seeing Avengers in the theater for the first time was something that was completely unique. It is the movie experience I had been looking for my entire life, basically. And even though there are movies in the Marvel Cinematic Universe past that where I've had that kind of experience as well, seeing both Endgame and Infinity War, like in Endgame, I literally had tears. Not sad tears, but I had happy tears streaming down my face in Endgame through the entire final sequence as they were going through that. But the Avengers is something special, and the whole sequence that kicks off, we'll never see the like again. As we've you mentioned that we'll probably never see any phenomenon like that in the media landscape in our lifetime. So unique.
No, I don't think you will. And I think before you do, again, there's going to be a lot of disappointing things that happen. And if ever someone tries to recapture it, it's going to fail. You can't force something like that. It's either going to happen or it's not.
Yeah. And so now we get to the point where the crux of the conversation becomes true. Like, superhero movies were big money, big business for probably, 15, 20 years up until that point. And it was at that point that they took over the landscape. Every studio wanted to have a tentpole of that kind to make money off of. Mm-hmm. Nobody did it like Disney did. So we are we're probably right past the boom. And because of COVID-19, we can probably mark it on a calendar. We're probably right past the boom. And we're probably going into another era of cinema. And I believe that these movies do have legs that will continue on, but it will never be quite the same. But going forward, do you think that the cultural landscape of the coming decade, and perhaps even the decade after that, will be dominated by the same kinds of properties?
No. Don't get me wrong. What has been done in the last 15 years, and I'm not even going to just say 10 years, because that's the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Everything that's been done in the last 15 years has been great and wonderful. But before that, I mean, like the 80s, it was all big action, muscle-bound heroes, your Schwarzeneggers, your Stallones, who dominated box office revenue. That was the trend. And that was a trend for about a good 10 years. then you get your secondary trend of whatever the 90s held for us. I think it was rom-coms that were doing a lot of stuff. And then you get into this with the superhero. I don't think you're going to have... I mean, there's always going to be superhero movies that are going to make money at your local Cineplex or now, you know, your local digital downloads. I think there's going to be something else that rises up in the next couple of years that's going to be the big, big money maker for Hollywood. And I just don't know what that... I don't know what that's going to be, but I don't think it's going to be the comic books. I think, like you said, we're past the big boom, and they still got a lot more fight left in them, but I don't think you're going to see the next big, big, huge blockbuster come from a comic book film.
I think that they will still be big business for a decade to come. Probably a decade to come. Like, I think that if it does appear in the theater, Wonder Woman 84 will do big business. I think that Black Widow, if it comes out at the right time, will be a billion-dollar movie easily just because we'll be starved for that kind of entertainment. But yeah, I think that we are probably on the downward trend. What do you think the chances are that James Cameron will own the next decade with his Avatar media empire?
Freaking none.
I'm excited to see what comes next. I'm really happy that I got to live in a generation that got this media output because growing up as a comic book nerd, it was incredibly fortuitous. I would never have imagined that we would have lived in this generation. So for me, I understand the draw. For the larger society, I think I get a kind of clearer picture as to how we got here. But Ray, I just want to thank you tremendously for having come on this. This was super cool.
It was.
Do you have anything that you would like to promote while you're on the show?
Yeah. Stay inside.
Yes, that's please, everybody. Like, be as safe as possible so that we can go outside again one day.
Exactly. That's the only thing I want to promote. That's the only thing I want to say. Stay inside. You don't have to protest. Stay inside. Anne Frank was able to do it. She was able to spend hours and hours and hours a day in a crawl space. You can stay in your home and download movies. Stay inside. But no, just stay inside and everyone be safe.
Excellent. I wholeheartedly agree with Ray's sentiment. And once again, thank you so much for being on the show, Ray. And thank you, everybody out there, for listening. If you enjoy listening to the episode, there are more interviews to come around a huge variety of topics. I may be recording again this week. It won't be out this week, but just to let you know, this will be an ongoing thing on the My Handle is Jonathan Blade podcast, which can be found and listened to on almost every podcatcher out there. There are ones that I've never heard of that my show is published on. So get out there, listen to me. Get at me on Twitter, or Jonathan Blade at Janky Old Broke Hobo Spider-Man. And hopefully we'll get to talk to you soon. Thanks for listening.
In a world infatuated with comic fandom, comes a show to help us remember the talents that have inspired us.
Whoa, cut.
Oh, come on, it wasn't that bad.
It's a bit dramatic. Let's just tell them about the show, guys.
We are the Canned Air Podcast.
Join us weekly for a comedic trip through pop culture.
We also welcome some cool comic creators, as well as some of the voice and screen actors that helped shape your childhood.
Find us on cannedairpodcast.com and on the Evergreen Podcast Network.